mōhea ōko e ko ka aha. Inā he kuriana I mua o kea aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ke hanohano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nāoe mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. I noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Case number SCAP-18-68, Kalima v. State. Arguing for the appellees cross appellants, Carl M. Verity and Thomas R. Grandy. Arguing for the appellants cross appellees, Clyde J. Wadsworth. Also appearing for appellants cross appellees, Kimberly T. Guidry, Robert T. Nakatsuji, and Kaliko Onalani D. Fernandez. Argument on the merits.
All right, good morning, Aloha. Are you ready to proceed today?
Yes, Your Honor.
As a preliminary matter, the court has reviewed the notices of supplemental authorities and considered the state defendant's motion to strike and is going to grant the motion to strike. Also, with regard to our argument today, who will be arguing in what order? My understanding is Mr. Verity will be beginning with 14 minutes of argument. Mr. Vandy will follow with another 14 minutes. Then we will cross over to the state defendant's side. Mr. Wadsworth, you'll have 20 minutes. 2 minutes reserved for rebuttal by Mr. Verity and Mr. Grande, and then Mr. Wadsworth will have 10 minutes for rebuttal on this side. Is that what you all understand will take place?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Let's proceed.
Chief Justice Ruckenwald, members of the court, thank you for the opportunity on this anniversary of statehood to present the argument in this case to you. I'd like to acknowledge to the court the presence of many of the beneficiaries who are affected by this case who are also in attendance with us. They've been onipa'a, steadfast with us, and we're grateful for their support. In looking at the framework for this case, reference to the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act is useful, because it affirms the fiduciary duty of the state of Hawaii to faithfully administer the trust. How's that? Is that better? Okay, sorry about that. The Hawaiian Homes Commission Act affirms the sacred fiduciary duty of the state to faithfully administer the provisions of the act on behalf of the native Hawaiians who are present with us today. The principal purpose of the act is to place Native Hawaiians on the land for purposes of homesteading in a prompt and efficient manner. This case presents an opportunity to the court to remedy, in part, the state's failure for six decades to fulfill that solemn obligation. The case presents an opportunity for the court to say, time's up. No more waiting. Your remedy is provided by statute, and we intend the court below to enforce that remedy as intended by the legislature. In looking at the legislative history, I'm not going to repeat that because it's well covered in Kalima 1. One of the documents within the legislative history, though, that's in the record at Jeff's 130, page 223, is the conference committee report. This is one of those bills, remember, that goes all the way through the legislature and then in conference committee gets gutted and replaced by new language. So all the preceding legislative history is somewhat irrelevant for purposes of interpretation. Governor Ige, a signatory to that committee report, along with the other committee members, stated that it was the committee's intent that resolution of the claims brought pursuant to Chapter 674 would occur and be resolved by the panel by the end of the 1994 legislative session. I'll also refer you to Governor Waihe'e's testimony at trial, who similarly said that he envisioned a simple process that would be completed during his term as governor. That testimony is found at Jeff's 514, pages 71 through 74. He intended to be an informal process where claimants would not even need lawyers, and the panel would act as an investigatory and advocacy body, helping resolve these claims and present them for the legislature. Kalima One has stated that if the legislature wanted to limit the amount of damages available, they had the opportunity to do so. Legislature has always had control over resolution of this case and the cost to the state. They have taken no action whatsoever to resolve the claims that they stated in 1991 they intended to have resolved by 1994.
What did the trial court here obviously spend a lot of time trying to get the damages or address the issue of damages? In my understanding, in your portion of the argument, you're going to be addressing some of the areas where you think the court erred. What specifically do you think the court did in an erroneous manner, or are there particular areas you'd like to bring to our attention?
I will bring those matters to your attention now, Your Honor, and cut to the chase on the issue of damages. The first thing I would say about damages is many of the state's damages arguments are actually attempted limitations on liability. For example, the court's ruling and the state's advocacy for some sort of delay in damages awards. The legislature said damages begin to run at the time of breach. That's what the statute said, but the court pulled out of thin air a six-year waiting period. The state believes some sort of waiting period is appropriate with no basis whatsoever in the legislative history and obviously no evidentiary support. That's one area in which damages are severely impacted by an argument that is, in fact, not a damages argument, but, in fact, a liability argument. We think and the state agrees, that that selection of a six-year waiting period on damages is arbitrary. It's inconsistent with the statutory language that has no such limitation and should be struck down. Damages should run for the waiting list damage subclass from the time of application until the time of award or through current, depending on the person's particular circumstances.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is that because, in your view, it's irrelevant the period of time it would take to develop the parcel that the beneficiary is seeking to receive?
That's correct, Justice Wilson. That analysis of it takes time to develop land because we don't have resources or we don't have this or we don't have that. Those are excuses. Okay. The state has a solemn fiduciary obligation like any other trustee that was a condition of statehood 60 years ago to administer this trust in a manner that's consistent with trust principles. It doesn't get a gimme. If for example, a family puts its funds in deposit at the Bank of Hawaii in a trust fund and the beneficiaries come in, you know, a month later and say we'd like to draw down for, you know, purposes set by the trust, the bank doesn't say, well, you know what, we're busy, or we don't have tellers available, come back in 6 years. What would happen in that case? Everyone in this courtroom knows what would happen in that case, that they'd be sued rightfully for breaches of trust. The state can't plead incompetence as a defense to its fiduciary obligation. We'll admit that the department is woefully underfunded, as the Nelson case that this court has heard twice has established. But that isn't what this case is about, and it can't, the state's breaches of trust by not funding the Homelands Trust cannot be an excuse.
Then it would be your position that during the trial for damages, evidence pertaining to the nature of the parcel and the length of time it would take to develop the parcel would be irrelevant and inadmissible?
That's correct. It doesn't, because what it's being offered for in the guise of a fact argument is a defense to fiduciary liability. This is what's wrong with the entire case. The entire case is framed as if the state somehow gets a gimme. The state is supposed to be wrong. The state gets a different review of its fiduciary performance than any other fiduciary, the highest duty known in law.
Mr. Verity, as you know, the state is immune from suit, but allows, waives its sovereign immunity under certain circumstances. But one of the parts of the statute that remains is that prejudgment interest is not allowed against the state.
So
now you have argued that the plaintiffs are entitled to present-day value. How is that not prejudgment interest?
Okay. So prejudgment interest, as we set out in our papers, Your Honor, Justice Nakayama, the idea of prejudgment interest is to compensate for amounts that could be earned while the person was deprived of the funds. It is not to compensate for the weakening of the dollar. A good example by way of illustration is that at Lonnie's Lunch Truck in 1976 in Mapunapuna, you could buy a plate lunch for 90 cents and get free hot peppers on the side. You couldn't do that today because of inflation. Inflation is what the CPI adjustment is intended to do, and we're only asking the court, sui generis, okay? And you got to think about this because this is a case in which the state has waived liability all the way back to the Eisenhower administration, from Eisenhower to Reagan is the period we're talking about. That colors some of our other arguments as well. But in that case, to pay people in Eisenhower or Johnson or Nixon dollars deprives them of the benefits of homesteading, and that's especially true given the fact that many of the applicants in the period of the 1980s are still not on the land today.
So do you have a case that backs you up on that?
Right. So the cases, the court actually has approved the use of present value as a method of measuring damages. It does that in cases looking at future damages. Misaki versus General Motors is one such case. There are several others. I will also point the court to the the recent decision involving the two stagehands who were deprived of income, that's Minton versus Quintal, by the city and county. The reason I'm citing that case is it doesn't deal with the issue of present value, but it acknowledges that the consumer price index used by Dr. Laudat in the analysis of the economic damages was a proper way of assessing what their actual damages were. That's what we're advocating for, which is application of the consumer price index to account for the fact that the $1970 is worth pennies today.
What about the Library of Congress case, which specifically says that to take into consider inflation is in essence, the inflation factor adjustment is disguised as interest award?
So we acknowledge that the cases are all over the board on this. The reason that we submitted, and I understand the court denied the motion, but we submitted numerous cases yesterday, all of which look at present value as a means of assessing both past and future damages. This court itself, if you think about it logically, this court itself, in adopting present value as a measure of damages in Misaki, had to be thinking about the fact that it works both ways. You have to be able to have an expression of a compensation in a make-whole remedy, which is what this is. Remember, we're not talking about general damages, we're not talking about punitive damages, we're not talking about consequential damages. All of those have been taken off the board by the legislature. But the measure of damages is an economic one. What is the economic loss? What is the economic loss of the value of homesteading? And the economic loss of the value and benefits of homesteading is fair market rental value minus the dollar per year that you would be paying, expressed in terms of that year's dollar value. That's why CPI is being advocated for, because it is a true make-whole remedy.
Mr. Verity, I understand you're pointing to cases from other jurisdictions, and you're pointing to, I suppose, fairness, which was one of the purposes of the law. But what about the actual definition? The definition of actual damages says direct monetary out-of-pocket loss. It doesn't say direct monetary out-of-pocket amount. It doesn't say the out-of-pocket expense that was utilized. So, and it also has exceptions. In other words, The definition does not seem to specify or limit the ability for the claimant to be limited to the exact amount that was paid. It would have been very easy, in other words, for the legislature to say, look, we're going to limit this to the precise amount that was paid 60 years ago. But they didn't do that. The definition and the words that were used, in fact, seem to have inherent in them value. And I think that is what this definition is directed at, to kind of restore the person. And you don't restore the person by giving them 10 cents on the dollar.
That's correct, Your Honor. And just pointing to the history of the statute is that predating the statute is this court's decision in the food pantry case, in which the court defines the term actual damages in a leasehold context. That's at 58 Hawaii 606. It states that the damages for leasehold are expressed in terms of fair market rental value and the difference between what the lease amount stated is and what the fair market rental value would be. That's all we're asking for here, which is the difference between fair market rental value, which is a class-wide, and remember, this is the other, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but this is the other big point, is that fair market rental value is a class remedy. They're trying to attack the class certification order, which they have not appealed. The court has chosen a class-wide remedy, chosen fair market rental value. The state did not appeal the class certification order, and that is how out-of-pocket loss is measured. The restatement of trust, the restatement of property, which this court has adopted in the Kapi'olani Commercial Center case, all express the measure of damage for a lessee or a lessor's measure of damages, actual damages, in the manner that I've described. The legislature is presumed.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Verity. While you're on that subject, could I ask for some help on this idea of actual damages?
Yes.
Because we do have a statute that defines it here, right? 674-2. And help me with this. If I understand the point that's being made by the state, the method of calculating actual damages through the fair market rental value based on the best fit curve doesn't actually provide for actual damages. It provides for more than that. So if I understand that to be the state's argument, could you respond to that?
I believe that's correct, that the state is saying, out of one side of its mouth, the state is arguing, oh, actual damages mean you have to come in and show us every penny. Vehi Ching has to come in with her receipts from 1966 to current, because she psychically knew that the legislature was going to adopt a statute 25 years later that would give her a remedy, and she could prove to the penny what she was owed. That's their actual damages argument. On the other hand, when you look at their best fit argument, it's completely opposite. It's like, well, you know, we'll throw that out the window and don't nothing to look at, pass on by, nothing of interest over there. But that's exactly the point. If you look at both the Hallstrom testimony, their expert, as well as our expert's testimony, they both agreed on one thing. The most accurate way to measure damages is to look at the actual market data. The state wants to ignore that and instead substitute this best fit curve, which is really nothing more than a statistical device to reduce variation on a linear regression that has no basis whatsoever in reality. The second thing about the best fit curve is, when asked to explain it in his testimony, now this is a fact-based ruling, I grant you, the expert for the state, when I said, well, tell me how this is calculated. Well, how did the, he said, I can't explain it. It's beyond my pay grade. Well, if you can't explain the factual underpinnings of something, then it cannot be concluded to be rational. You have to be able to look at data and say, okay, this is one way of slicing and dicing it. They couldn't do that. But to your point, Justice Wilson, it's apparent that the state wants to have it both ways. and hold the beneficiaries to the penny on the out-of-pocket loss issue, but then flip the coin and say, well, good enough. Imagine what would happen.
Well, Mr. Verity, in all fairness, they argued against the fair market rental value model, and the court adopted it.
That's correct.
And once the court has adopted it, are you saying that the state can't argue then about how it should be applied?
Oh, no.
And even though it's opposite of what they wanted initially, they can still argue with the court how it should be applied.
Right. They can argue that, but what they can't do is, to be logically consistent, Justice Nakayama, they can't say that factual accuracy only applies sometimes, is only a requirement for measuring damages sometimes. So sure, they can take an alternate position. And they could say that we don't think the market data reflected in the numbers that we have is accurate for the following reasons. And they did that at trial. They said, for our sample size, they said, well, you know, your expert took a sample that was too small. And we said, you know, we'll concede that on our appeal. And what we'll live with is what your expert produced, which is the actual market data, which, you know, has a generally upward trend, but varies according to the linear line between the XY and according to market fluctuations. We'll live with that. And what we'll avoid in that case are two things. A unfairness argument from anybody, because all the class members have to say, okay, you know what, in 79 to 83 market was down, we live with that. 85 to 89 market was up, we live with that. But the other thing we don't do is artificially, and this is the class fairness argument, we do not artificially depress by 25% the total aggregate amount of recovery, which is what the Hallstrom best fit results in, and the state was well aware of that.
And then, I'm sorry.
My orange light is on, and I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
Shall we hear from Mr. Gandhi? You've allocated time between yourself and yourselves if you want to. I'd like to be sure that Mr. Gandhi gets an opportunity to argue.
If I could just say one
more.
I'll just wrap up. I just want to point out that on the deferral argument, which the court has not asked a question about, if you look at the two deferral rulings made that are the subject of the appeal, they are internally inconsistent and inconsistent with each other, because on the one hand, and let me please turn to that so I don't speak incorrectly, the damages for the subclass member do not accrue during the period from the date of the receipt of the deferral letter, and that's because of non-response, no interest, or failing to pre-qualify, until the lease award date for that particular offering. Okay, that's pretty clear. Unless the beneficiary proves by rebuttal evidence that mitigation was excused because the claimant self-selected for financial reasons. Now, that's totally inconsistent with the department's position that says we can defer you because you don't pre-qualify and your damages are cut off forever. It's also inconsistent with the court's own ruling that deferral for failure to pre-qualify is okay.
How does financial disqualification have anything to do with whether or not someone should be a claimant and how it affects their claim? If there was enough resources so that everybody had enough lots, why would the financial qualifications even enter into this?
That's exactly right, and this is exactly what it cycles back to, and I was saying to Justice Wilson, Justice Pollack, and that is that the state cannot say our lack of resources and mismanagement of the trust means that we have to parse out the little bit we have in a very stingy way, and we're only going to give it to people that we think can succeed. Even though the Admissions Act, Section 4 of the Admissions Act, prevents the state per se from adopting any qualifications that aren't in the Hawaii Homes Commission Act, and they've done that repeatedly throughout this case and throughout the arguments they're making about the application of 674. Just turning to the last point, and then I'll sit down. I'm sorry, I'm going so far over time. But the other self-contradictory point in deferral is the court has a second ruling on deferral that says that defendants may offer as a defense evidence that a particular waiting list damages subclass members' financial disqualification caused the deferral. How can that be reconciled with the rule that I just read to you where economic qualifications, inability to meet pre-qualifications can be offered as both deferral and mitigation? There's no way of reconciling that order. And to your point, Justice Pollack, this is made up out of whole cloth. It's not in the statute. It's a limitation prohibited by the Admissions Act, which says the state cannot limit beneficiary qualifications, which are 50% Hawaiian or 25% for successors, 18 years of age. The argument on deferral that the court ought to adopt, and which where we actually have quite a bit of congruence with the state, is that if you're offered a paper lease, and you reject it, then you have not fulfilled your duty to mitigate. That's how deferral should work. Otherwise, think about it. You're deferred. When does the new clock start ticking? If there's another offering at the same date that you get the deferral letter, are you not deferred for that offering? It's impossible to apply. It's self-contradictory. There's no basis for it in the statute, and it's prohibited by the Act. It's totally inconsistent, the Admissions Act, and it's totally inconsistent with the remedial purposes of the statute. And I know that the state went on at some length criticizing us for our emphasis, the remedial nature of the statute. But this is all found in Kalima 1. The state said, yeah, the waiver on liability for sovereign immunity, we'll construe that narrowly. That's the way it is. Those are the rules we all live with. However, a remedial statute, the coin flips, and any doubts have to be resolved in favor of achieving the remedy that the statute was designed to provide. In this case, compensation for now 6 decades of mismanagement for a limited class of claimants who got in the front door for a limited remedy for economic damages. That's what we're asking for. I thank the court for its attention and its questions and for the additional time. Thank you so much.
Mr. Gandy.
May it please the court, aloha. The state has conceded liability in this case and instead has focused on limiting who can get damages and reducing subclass-wide and individual damages. There's a common error that runs through the state's positions that we oppose, and that is this. The state consistently fails to follow the plain language of the statute, the plain language of DHHL regulations, and the clear mandate and rulings of this court. And as a consequence, these positions turn Chapter 674 on its head. And we end up with absurd results that the legislature could not possibly have intended.
What language in 674 are you referring to?
There are several areas, two of which Mr. Verity referred to with respect to out-of-pocket loss and deferral.
Isn't the plaintiff's theory out-of-pocket going out-of-pocket? In other words, you're going out of that definition for the benefit of the bargain.
Not at all, Your Honor. If you look at what the term out-of-pocket loss means, it's defined in Black's Law Dictionary. It's the difference between the fair market value and what's actually offered or what's actually is expended. This, as Mr. Verity referenced, this court adopted that rule in the Kapi'olani commercial case and in the Malanai case. So it's a term of art that refers to the loss that someone made, not the expenditures that.
What about the two adjectives before out of pocket? Direct, monetary.
That's an excellent question. Consequentials are not allowed. Direct says direct means not indirect. Monetary. It restricts it to monetary out-of-pocket loss, not non-monetary out-of-pocket loss, like loss of personal property.
Mr. Grant, can I interrupt?
Certainly.
I think you mentioned the Malani versus Clapp case.
as support for the argument that the benefit of the bargain damages, so to speak, is consistent with the statutory definition of damages in 674. But does that case really say that?
I want to apologize to the court on behalf of the defendants and the plaintiffs, because I think that we're a little cavalier in using the terms benefit of the bargain and out-of-pocket loss. Both are terms of art.
But pardon me for interrupting you, but because what you cite in your brief is a quote from that case that says out-of-pocket loss, and that case does not say that.
And I will apologize for that as well, Your Honor. That was not intended to be a quote. It was a parenthetical. The quote was not supposed to be in there. The Molinai case does not talk about and does not mention out-of-pocket loss. It does talk about the type of damages which out-of-pocket loss represents, which is the difference between the fair market value and what was paid or what was offered.
Okay. Can I ask a follow-up question? So I think what, if I heard Mr. Varity correctly, I think he said the model that the circuit court had adopted, the fair market rental value model, was a good approximation of what the class-wide damages would be. Is that correct?
Correct.
And how is that consistent with the language in 674.2 that says actual damages or direct monetary out-of-pocket losses sustained by the claimant individually rather than the beneficiary class generally?
Okay. That was really addressed in the Act 14 case, where basically there was a settlement of $600 million. In that act, the language in 674 was specifically modified to ensure that compensation to the trust as a whole did not affect any individual rights to damages. I'd like to address the state's points on appeal in three major areas that they challenge. First are rulings made by Judge Hefo. The second are challenges to the class list and five categories of claimants that the state seeks to exclude. And the third is challenges to procedures used to determine damages. The first absurd position that the state takes is its four-step damages model, which it proposes to replace the fair market rental value model adopted by the trial court, mandated by Chapter 674 and this court's precedent.
Well, I don't disagree with you, Mr. Grandy. However, that wasn't adopted by the court, so that isn't a point of error on appeal.
I'm sorry, what was not adopted by a court, Your Honor?
The state's four-step proposal to determine a class-wide damages.
Correct. The state.
So the court didn't adopt it, so it can't be error by the court.
No, the state is proposing that this court replace the fair market rental value model with its four-step model.
Mr. Grandy, if I could, you know, we'd set aside a set amount of time and for half hour for each side. The plaintiff side has used a half hour. I'm going to allow you to keep going. I would ask you to keep your arguments sort of to the point or cut to the chase on each of them, and we'll give extra time to the state defendants to respond.
But I'd be happy to do that. I'd be happy to do that, Your Honor. The four-step model that the state is proposing has several key deficiencies. It's based on two elements of proof. First, missing financial records. The testimony of DHHL designated representative Rodney Lau was summarized in Judge Hefo's opinion, and Mr. Lau testified that DHHL did not have auditable financial records until 1985, and he couldn't find any financial records from 1962 to 1972. This is the basis of the four-step model, and these are records that don't exist. The second failure of the four-step model is that it is based upon an estimate of future homestead production that Judge Hefo has already rejected. In paragraph 17 of her opinion, Judge Hefo called the state's expert's estimate of future homestead production speculative. Significantly, and this relates to the issue of fair market rental value and what the state's position is, the state uses fair market rental value as a part of its model. In the state's opening brief at page 36, note 29, the state says, quote, purchasers should be awarded the fair rental value of the alternative land purchased. So for those three reasons, the four-step model is absurd, makes no sense, and we urge...
Could I interrupt you just for a second?
Certainly.
I know you're focusing on why we shouldn't adopt the four-step model, but getting back to the model that was adopted by the Circuit Court, no doubt you are a proponent of the fair market rental value calculation method that was used, but let me ask you to respond to the state's point that this fair market rental value calculation goes beyond actual damages and awards damages that are in excess of actual damages.
I don't know how it could go beyond actual damages, since fair market rental value is based upon, you know, what the market rent is, and it's reduced by the dollar per year that the claimants would have to pay for that. So there's no position that's sustainable that says it offers more money. Now, certainly, it would offer more money than under the state's model and under the state's theory of what out-of-pocket loss is. It would offer more than a homeless person who would get nothing if the court adopts the state's position. Or it would offer more to a rich person who would get more if the court offers the state's position. So I think that's simply incorrect, Your Honor.
Their argument is that it should be demonstrated out-of-pocket expenses. What's your response to that? That's at least an element of that argument. We'll certainly hear from Mr. Waz.
That is one measure of out-of-pocket loss, but it's not what the statute says. If the legislature had intended out-of-pocket expense, it would have said out-of-pocket expense. Instead, it said out-of-pocket loss.
Why is that so determined in your mind? Could you just explain that point? That seems like a very subtle distinction. Could you explain for the court why it's so critical?
With respect, Your Honor, it's not subtle at all. You follow the plain language of the statute. Out-of-pocket loss is a term of art. It's defined in Black's Dictionary. It's followed by this court's precedent. It's the loss. It is the measure of damages for landlord-tenant damages, and this is a landlord-tenant case. To return to a final argument that the state makes with respect to the deficiencies in the fair market rental value model, it says that there's no connection between the liability and the type of model that was adopted for damages. The answer to that is the fact of damage and causation was proven in the 2009 damages trial at the request of the state.
Mr. Brady, can I ask you a question about the requirement for financial viability in order to get a parcel of land, a residential land that we're talking about now? I don't know how workable it is, because there are some Hawaiian homesteads that have houses on them already.
Correct.
Is that helping anybody to award somebody that house when the person is not able to pay the taxes on it?
That's a totally separate issue, Your Honor. They do offer completed homesteads, and certainly in that instance, you have to have people to be financially pre-qualified to take over that amount.
Okay. Then also for residential lots, they're all zoned residential, right?
Correct.
So don't the lots have to have a residence on them?
The lots have to be occupied within 1 year of award.
Right.
Exactly.
So are you saying a tent would be okay?
That's not really what the issue is in this case.
I guess the question is whether it's reasonable to say that the state shouldn't, or the HAR shouldn't, require some sort of financial viability, even to pay land taxes.
We're not saying that at all, Your Honor. The DHHL can do that in its award of homesteads. It's done it. It's just that it's done it in violation and not in accordance with the statute and not in accordance with the regulations. Where the state goes too far is attempting to impose it in this case and say, unless you have the financial wherewithal to pay for a $300,000 loan, you don't get damages. That position turns the whole statute on its head. And as I mentioned earlier, if you're affluent and you can afford the money, well, under their model, you get more. And if you're poor, under their model, you get nothing.
Anything else to wrap up? Again, I want to be fair to both sides and make sure that Mr. Wadsworth does that.
I understand, Your Honor. I'll wrap up here. We've argued our other points in our brief, which the court can rely on, and I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Wasserman.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Clyde Wadsworth, appearing on behalf of the state of Hawaii and the related defendants. In 1991, the legislature gave Hawaiian Homelands Trust beneficiaries a carefully limited right to sue the state for actual money damages resulting from the state's past breaches of trust. While this is a remedial measure, this court recognized in Kalima 1 that it's also a waiver of sovereign immunity that must be strictly enforced. In a series of rulings on damages and class issues, the circuit court went far beyond the plain language of the statute, Chapter 674, and improperly expanded the scope of the state's immunity waiver. This appeal focuses on the errors the circuit court made in adopting a damages model and a class list in conflict with the statute.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just want to be clear. Are you contesting the findings of breach?
Only in one small respect, Your Honor, that we have briefed, but that I don't plan to address today unless the court has questions. My plan today is to address three of the damage issues first, the measure of damages, when they begin to run, and who has the burden of proof. And I plan then to address the inflation issue assuming I have time in my opening statement.
Mr. Wadsworth, regarding the class list, plaintiffs make an argument that why not proceed with the class list and let the administrator then weed out the people that don't qualify, and therefore then they'll be bound by the judgment in this case. Why would you want to take those people out and give them a separate cause of action and not be included in this class at this point?
If I could just, I think we have folks here who might not have been able to get seats. Could we address, if they would like to come in, we can open the back of the courtroom and take a brief recess. Certainly one of you who wants to come in to be able to do so.
Oh. Well, they do want to come in. We'll take a recess.
Why don't we take a brief recess so that we can just determine whether anyone else wants to come in and make sure if we need to, we can open the back of the courtroom. So the court will take a brief recess at this time.
So to answer Justice Nakayama's question, the problems with the subclass list, the circuit court included hundreds of people on the list who were never really properly part of the class. Those include claimants who settled with the individual claims panel, those who failed to submit timely written notice, those who were not on the homestead waiting list, those who didn't satisfy the Native Hawaiian blood quantum, and others who are categorically not qualified. The significance of this, Your Honor, is that the circuit court's order establishing the subclass list, along with the Rule 54B judgment, resulted in the state being found liable to these individuals who never had a viable claim with the state.
Don't you think the plaintiffs have waived the argument that by virtue of the court's order and certification, they're bound, the state is bound to pay them by stating they can be knocked off the list by the master?
Well, I don't think they have said that with respect to all of the categories that we've identified that they can all be knocked off the class list. If they agree to that this morning, I think yes, that the issue would be over. I mean, the other aspect of this is that with them on the class list in the claims administration process, the burden of proof has been shifted to the state in many respects, including disproving out-of-pocket damages, which I plan to address in my opening statement. So the first flaw in the damages model adopted by the court, the circuit court's damages model doesn't measure the claimant's direct monetary out-of-pocket loss, as the statute requires, and is the money that each claimant paid out-of-pocket for alternative land as a result of the breach of trust. This court's decisions treat out-of-pocket loss as money paid from one's own funds. In Zanicus Pico versus Cutter Dodge, for example, the court defined out-of-pocket loss as the money that the plaintiff spent as a consequence of their reliance on the defendant's advertisement.
Mr. Wadsworth, I'm going to go a little bit off, but along those same lines, the court asked both parties to submit a model for the class-wide determination of damages. The state submitted with a model that was seemingly unworkable, and especially because you want each subclass member to submit actually what they spent out of pocket, when what we're looking for is a model to apply across the class. And now you're saying that the court erred by using the fair market rental value. Even if that's true, aren't you supposed to be helping the court and both the plaintiffs and you to try to come up with a viable model? And the court told you that this was not a good model and asked for a new model, and you submitted the same thing again. So how are you performing your duty, not you, but your office, performing the duties by assisting the court in coming up with a good model to assess class-wide damages?
So the model, Your Honor, addresses the second issue that I wanted to talk about today, which is when damages begin to run. I'll return to measure out-of-pocket loss a little later, but to answer your court's question. So the question here is when damages begin to run, and that's the court adopted this 6-year rule, which I think both sides believe is arbitrary. So the state suggested a 4-step model, which I'll explain, and then I'll get into the criticisms of it. So the state proposed a 4-step model that would quantify the loss to the trust as a result of each of the 4 breaches. How many more homesteads would have been developed but for that loss to the trust? How much shorter each claimant's wait time would have been had the additional homesteads been developed? And then from there, each claimant's out-of-pocket loss could be determined. So that is what the state put forward as an alternative model to address the issue of how to determine when the period begins to run and how damages should be calculated. So the criticism of that model from the other side is, well, you can't do, and so the first 2 steps of that could be done on a class-wide basis. How much money was lost to the trust, how many homesteads would have been developed absent the loss to the trust.
Is that easy to determine how much money was lost to the trust as a result of the breaches?
Correct.
How is that going to be figured out?
Okay. Well, so the first step would in determining the loss to the trust, both sides could put on expert testimony, which happened in the damages model here. Both sides would put on expert testimony regarding the amount of revenue bonds, for example, because that was one of the breaches of trust that could have been issued to DHL based on its revenue stream. And
the other side criticize. And so experts, bond experts, could testify as to the amount of revenue and bonds that could have been issued. The other side says, well, there are no financials to establish that. But in fact, plaintiffs have a complete set of revenue and expenditure data for DHHL for every year of the damages period that was obtained from the Department of Accounting and General Services. Their own expert recognized this at trial. This is at ICA 196 at PDF 445-53. They have a complete set of revenue and expenditure data for DHHL for every year of the damages period. So a bond expert could use these records to determine how much the amount of revenue bonds that could have been issued but for that breach of trust. So the second step then is to determine how many more homestead lots would have been developed if the trust had that money. And again, the parties have submitted evidence, and the plaintiffs have it, evidence as to the past costs during the class period of developing homesteads, for each year of the class period. So it could be determined, you know, how many additional homesteads through expert testimony. Again, and this is no more complicated, Your Honor, than the expert testimony that was provided during the fair market value trial, where there were many experts that had to testify about many different models and the bases for those models during the first trial. The third step then, you know, how much shorter each claimant's wait time would have been can be determined from the waiting lists. There are numerous waiting lists in the record plaintiffs could use to determine how much sooner each subclass member would have gotten off the waiting list with those additional homesteads developed. And then out-of-pocket loss, that's peculiar year relief within the plaintiff's ability to prove. But
the whole purpose of having a model is to have a class-wide model of damages instead of having over 2,700 separate trials.
In class actions, damages issues are often individualized. I mean, you can have a class-wide basis for determining liability. You can even have a class-wide basis for determining certain other damage-related issues. But when it comes to individualized issues of damages, there can be a claim process or even individualized damages trials. And here the circuit court adopted a claims process by which then each individual claimant would come forward with a claim form.
So you're actually agreeing with the plaintiffs that you think that each plaintiff should have to have saved their receipts for rent since 1959?
This goes to the method of proof, Your Honor, not the measure of damages. So I think there could be alternative methods
of
proof. There could be alternative methods of proof for a claimant to establish their out-of-pocket loss.
But each claimant must individually establish that claimant's out-of-pocket loss instead of having a class-wide model?
Yes, Your Honor. And even under the circuit court's model, each claimant has to establish the period of time. Under the circuit court's claims process, each claimant still has to establish the period of time that they spent money out-of-pocket on alternative land. So that happens regardless under the circuit court's claims administration process. But our point is that there could be alternative methods for a claimant to establish out-of-pocket loss. If they do have receipts, if they do have records, if they do have leases, that would be obviously the best evidence. They could testify. If they don't have those records, they could testify that they rented land or an apartment or whatever.
Isn't the purpose of having a class-wide model to avoid having each of the over 2,700 people having to submit specific proof of losses? I mean, this is a class action.
No, Your Honor. In short, in class actions all of the time, there are, class actions determine liability, causation issues, but because there are individual differences in issues and damages, and there are defenses that are individualized, those have to be allowed for, if not in a mini trial, some type of claim process so that the claimant can come forward with their evidence of a claim, and the defendant is permitted to assert all applicable defenses in that claim process.
Can Mr. Tell you, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, sir. To that point, can you address the arguments that Mr. Verity and Mr. Grandi made that part of the problem that the part of the proof problem that the plaintiffs face is that, first of all, this claim didn't arise until the act was effective. So for that, from the Eisenhower administration all the way through the Reagan administration, there was no claim because the state was immune. So we have that 30-plus year period of time, 20-plus year period of time, where the individual claimants didn't even have a claim. So how are they to accumulate the evidence that the state is now asking them to prove that they actually have a valid claim?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, if they haven't kept rental receipt, I mean, if they're not a pack rat like me who keeps everything, if they haven't kept that kind of evidence, they could testify. They could credibly testify that they rented an apartment, you know, in someplace on Oahu, and they paid such and such amount.
Do you remember what they paid in 1967? I don't remember what I paid in 1967. I couldn't even come close to guessing.
Well, you know, the thing is, Your Honor, I understand that the circuit court should be able to determine alternative methods of proof. It never did that, because it equated out-of-pocket loss with benefit of the bargain damages, and clearly that is an error, that those are contract damages, expectations.
Can you explain, you kind of really pushed that argument, and if you could just explain it to us in a way that,
okay,
without, you know, sort of resorting to that actual phrase, explain exactly how you think the court went wrong and how it ran afoul of the statute.
Okay.
Awarding what it did, which seems to be, again, this model of looking at what it would have cost in Nanakuli, 5,000 square foot lot. What's wrong with that? What's fundamentally wrong with that approach?
It gives the claimants their expectation damages. It gives them not their out-of-pocket loss, but it gives them the benefit of the bargain, which is the value of what the plaintiff expected to receive minus what he or she actually received.
Isn't
contract damage.
But isn't that what Black's Dictionary?
No, Your Honor. That's the benefit of the bargain damages, expectation.
But I think I looked it up, and it says if you look up the exact phrase, out-of-pocket losses, it seems to cite a case from 1921 or something, and it talks about
it. It says what the value the buyer paid, the difference between the value of what the buyer paid and the market value of what was received in return. That's out-of-pocket loss. That's different than benefit of the bargain, which is the value of what the plaintiff expected to receive minus the value of what he actually received. So it's the difference between contract damages, where the defendant is put to the benefit of the bargain and you get what you expected to receive under the contract, versus tort damages, where you get your out-of-pocket loss. The legislature is very specific. Few statutes are this specific in identifying the measure of damages. In fact, I'm aware of no other Hawaii statute that specifically measures the measure of damages. And the legislature is even more specific. It says direct monetary out-of-pocket loss, and you can't include consequential damages. I think the legislature couldn't have been clearer that out-of-pocket loss is the measure. And fair market rate.
This model is sort of a proxy for out-of-pocket damages. I mean, in complex class actions, there are all kinds of approaches taken, where there's samples done, extrapolations from those samples that are generally thought of as legitimate. Why couldn't this be viewed as an attempt to come up with, in essence, a sort of an extrapolation model?
Because
one you might disagree with. Why is that actual approach illegitimate in the state's view?
Because it doesn't measure out-of-pocket damage. Fair market rental value measures the value of what you would have received had you gotten a homestead lot. That by definition is expectation damages. It's benefit bargaining damages. It's I mean, this is a, you know, as opposing counsel said, these are terms of art that are well known in the law.
What if the person I hypothesized a while back can't remember what their damages are, what they paid in 1997, and many people can't remember what they paid in 1997? Does that mean they're out of luck, or could the court not adopt some method of estimating, of sampling, of looking at what one might reasonably assume the damages would have been? Is that not what was done here? Why is that? Why is what was done here not something like that, which is the kind of thing that I believe does happen in class action when there's this type of indefiniteness?
Right. So if the circuit court wanted to deal with alternative methods of proof for out-of-pocket loss, it could have done that and come up with varying ways to measure out-of-pocket loss, the best evidence being, you know, receipts, documentation. The next best evidence being credible testimony from a claimant that they, you know, spent rent on alternative land, in such and such an area, if they remember the amount of land. I suppose another method would be, you know, if the claimant couldn't determine couldn't remember what their amount of rent was, and their relatives couldn't remember, you know, their friends could remember, they could say, well, I lived in this specific, location on Oahu, I know I lived there, you know, in this number of years, and this is what rents were going for in that
location. Why isn't what the court did here very close to what you just described?
Because the court adopted it as a benefit of the bargain damages model. It didn't say this is an alternative method of proof when nothing else is left.
Can I interrupt you on that point?
Yes.
Because I understand that your position is that the court adopted a benefit of the bargain evaluation. However, in getting back to the Chief Justice's point, isn't it? If you consider our application of a clearly erroneous standard to this technique that the court devised, isn't it within the discretion of the court to come up with what this could be described as an alternative method of evaluation, where the court takes 122 sales of property over a period from 1959 to 2013? In other words, there is not a focus on just the benefit of the bargain for each individual claimant, but there is this alternative method of evaluation that takes into consideration all these sales, and then doesn't necessarily even accept that as the form of the ultimate calculation of damages, but anticipates a further hearing where now your suggestion, your scenario, for example, could well come into play, where after starting off with this fair market rental value calculation, the court then looks at an individual who rented a property in Kahala and says, well, we can't use that as a measure of damages because that would be extreme. And so there's an opportunity as the process unfolds to get closer to what I guess you're talking about, which is actual damages as opposed to just a benefit of the bargain. So why wouldn't that process
because the baseline here, is measuring expectation damages, what you would have received had you gotten a lot.
Damages, I'm thinking of maybe a claimant saying, look, I could have had a property in 1999 when the market value was X, and I want to use that value. And the court could well say, well, you don't actually get the benefit of the bargain. This is an actual loss. So we're not going to take it based on what you think was the time period when you would have gotten the property. Instead, the valuation is going to be based on a period of time that extends from 1959 to 2013, and it's based on 122 sales. That's a lot different than just direct benefit of the bargain, it seems.
But the whole objective of the model, I'm not saying that the model isn't doesn't have a lot behind it, but the whole objective of the model is to measure expectation damages, not out-of-pocket loss, as the statute requires. And we must comply with the statutory language, specifically when it's so specific. And the alternative is to waive the state's immunity.
Does your excuse me?
It wasn't intended.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead and let me.
Okay. No, I guess my time is up.
Well,
but okay. I want to answer.
We'll give you more time.
Okay.
You
know, okay.
You've got about 7 minutes over. I'll go ahead and I'll give you 7 minutes, and whether you want to take an hour or go to the end is fine. So go ahead and take it now because you know.
Okay.
Marco Rubio, I'm sorry.
You've been arguing the out-of-pocket model, and I guess what I'm trying to make understand is how is that consistent with arguing these mitigation tools that you want to apply or mechanisms? You want to say, first of all, the definition doesn't say anything about mitigation, number one. But number two, one of your arguments, I think if I understood it correctly, is that there's a duty to mitigate on the individual complainant or the individual claimant on these cases from the very day that they first file or register. Is that what the argument is of the state?
Well, I'm not sure which argument you're identifying, Your Honor, but in terms of mitigation, we actually argue that most of what the other side of what the plaintiffs argue are mitigation issues. We argue that they are causation issues because the statute requires that the actual damages result from the breach of trust. So, for example, if we look at the deferral issue, which the other side raised, our argument is that the state should not be responsible for delay that's caused. The delay that's caused by a claimant's own failure to participate.
How is their own failure to participate when the state has such limited lots available? They set financial criteria. In other words, it seems like by setting the financial qualifications, they determine who's going to be an appropriate claimant.
Your Honor, our argument, though, is that this will only apply if the state is able to show that the person would have received a homestead in the offering that they either said that they weren't interested in or failed to respond to. Our argument is that we should be able to, it's not that, I think at one point the plaintiff said, oh, they won't get any damages. Our argument isn't that these plaintiffs won't get any damages. It's that their damages will be cut off if they, by their own actions, decided not to participate in an offering because that is an action.
You know, I think this is concerning to me, the way you're phrasing this. They cut themselves, that you said, by their own actions, are their own actions because they didn't financially qualify, and the financial qualifications are the ones set by the state, and there's no requirement in order to get a lot that they have to satisfy financial qualifications?
These are two different issues, Your Honor.
I agree with you, they're two different issues.
So in the first case, we have claimants who may have refused to respond or said they weren't interested dozens of times, okay? And our position, is, for whatever reason, and our position is that person, the delay that's being caused there, can't be attributed to the state. Part of it, the first part of the delay can, to the extent that before they started deferring. But our position with respect to those folks is that at a certain point, the delay is being caused by the fact that you're not responding or you're deferring participation, and so the state shouldn't be responsible for that because it's not the damage isn't as a result of the breach of trust, and so it's a causation issue. On the deferrals because of people who couldn't financially qualify. So the issue here is that the Homestead Act itself, and I have both the version of statehood and also the current version. So at statehood, there was a provision in the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. The lessee shall occupy and commence to use or cultivate the tract as his home or farm with 1 year after after the lease is made. And there's a similar provision now in the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act, which provides that the lessee may be required to occupy and commence to use the tract as the lessee's home within 1 year after the commencement of the term of the lease. So in order to build a home, you have to be able to financially qualify. And if you can't financially qualify, I think, you know, we can all agree that that's a frustrating and a horrible position to be in, but that isn't a delay that's caused by the state's breach of trust. And so it's a causation issue. We're not, you know, it's not like we're trying to take advantage of poor folks. It's just that that is not a situation that the statute allows for the state.
Are you arguing that the statute...
It's not a result of the breach of trust.
You're arguing, I hope you're not arguing, that the statute requires financial qualification in order to get a lot?
I think the statute requires that you be on a home within a year, and the only way you can have a home on the lot is to purchase it, because the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act doesn't give the recipient a house. It just gives them the land and the infrastructure. So the house has to be purchased by the claimant. I'd like to, if I may, I'd like to turn to the inflation argument. So plaintiffs are not entitled to an inflation adjustment to their damages because it's just another name for prejudgment interest that's prohibited by HRA 661-8. The courts that have looked at this issue in an analogous context have held that inflation is an element of prejudgment interest. In particular, as Justice Nakayama mentioned, in Library of Congress versus Shaw, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a Title VII case where the plaintiff's attorney sought a fee award that would compensate him for delay in payment, that Congress had not waived the federal government's immunity from interest, and that an inflation adjustment was just a disguised interest award. And the court specifically ruled that prejudgment...
Mr. Wadsworth, do you think that when our legislature passed 674, it meant to override
the prohibition, 661-8.
Yeah, the prohibition of prejudgment interest?
No, I think if it had meant to override, it would have to have specifically said so, since that would be a waiver of sovereign immunity. So in the Library of Congress case, the court ruled that prejudgment interest is considered damages and said, quote, the character or nature of interest cannot be changed by calling it damages, loss, earned increment, just compensation, discount, offset, or penalty, or any other term, because it is still interest, and the no interest rule applies to it.
And Gaspro, our case, gives it a very restrictive meaning of that statute, does it not?
Which case?
Gaspro, Van Gaspro, and I think the Rodriguez case as well, both of those cases. Interest is used in a limited sense of compensation for the delay of use of money due as damages. We attribute the same limited meaning to interest in 660.
Actually, I think Your Honor, the Rodriguez case and the County of Hawaii case both say that the interest is compensation for delay in payment of money damages.
But that's not what this is it? This isn't delay. This is the value.
It's damages for the delay in payment. The theory is that the dollars are worth less now than they were at the time, and that's caused by the delay. This also gets into the statute prohibiting consequential damages, because the delay here is not caused by the breaches. It's caused by the passage of time and the fact that there's been inflation. There could have been deflation. This also is prohibited by the specific part of the statute that prohibits consequential damages. But I don't think. So there's that, and then there's the case law. I think in both Rodriguez and County of Hawaii, where this court has characterized interest as compensation for delay in payment of money damages. And I think it's very difficult then to get around that language to try to characterize this as anything but interest.
What about the 6-year waiting period? Could you address that motion that the 6-year time period that has to pass?
Yes, Your Honor. As the court knows, under the court's 6-year rule, each claimant's damages begin 6 years after being placed on the homestead waiting list. regardless of the actual delay that was caused by the breaches. So our argument is that this six-year period is completely unconnected to the breaches. It's basically, you could take away all the breaches or take away all but one, it's still going to be 6 years. There's no connection between the breaches having caused this six-year delay. And that's what our four-step damages model is designed to do. It's designed to quantify how the breaches translate into damages. So as it is now, we have a six-year rule that is unconnected to the damages model, and it's based on solely on the testimony of one former deputy in the Hawaiian Homelands Commission office, who actually said that this was the optimal site development time at that time when he testified in 2009, if DHHL had had all the resources that it needed. So the Judge Hippo found that there were other problems causing the delay in development of homesteads, including insufficient or poor quality or relatively remote locations of land, and also that the legislature did not have a constitutional duty to fund the trust. So there were other reasons.
Can I interrupt you for a moment while you're on that point? I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Wadsworth, but just to be clear about your calculation of damages. So you would discard this 5 or 6 year period that was based on, I guess, the general proposition would take that long to develop a parcel, and you would begin calculating damages based on, I guess, the date that the lease is available.
We would be
except for those who can't financially qualify.
No. Your Honor, the way we would figure this out is through our four-step model. So we would determine the loss to the trust. We would determine how many more, but for that monetary loss to the trust, how many more homesteads could have been developed. And then we would go through the waiting list to see how much sooner the claimant could have gotten their homestead. And so if that turns out to be 4 years, 5 years, whatever it is, the state's stuck with that.
But it's based on, given your calculations, it's based on a time when the claimant would have been able to get the lease, correct? After you go through your calculations, you're sort of
yes, prognosticating. It's an estimate, right. Yes, yeah. It's an estimate of when
you're prognosticating how much of a delay there would have been given the lack of assets to the trust and the fact that if they managed the trust properly and had adequate assets, then there wouldn't have been as long a wait, and you're going to take that period and then assign to each claimant a date when they could have entered into a lease, and then the damages would start from that date, except for those who can't qualify financially.
No, I'm sorry. We have to. It's the amount of time that they waited minus when they would have gotten a lease. So that's the waiting period, right? But
you start the calculations. I mean, the calculation of when damages
would
occurred
gotten, right.
would have been the
right.
point
yes.
under these calculations.
Right.
When
Which
all
could
of
be
them
4 years. It could be 6 years. It could be 10 years.
Could it be never for certain folks, or would everybody eventually, under your model, would there be enough resources at some point in time, and when would that be for everybody, all the claimants to get?
Well, everyone who's on the residential waiting list has at least been offered, who was during the claim period, everyone who's on the waiting list for a residential homestead has at least been offered the opportunity.
That's so provided they satisfy financial qualifications, though.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. That is true.
When you say offered, do you mean that letter that they send out to 1,000 people and there's only 42 lots? Is that what you mean by an offer?
Yes, that's what I mean, because a claimant can't get a homestead without participating in the process. It's just not possible. And there are claimants who have deferred or not answered many, many times. And that delay cannot be attributed to the state.
Mr. Wadsworth, how long is Mr. Wadsworth?
Mr. Wadsworth has gone just about 2 seconds shorter than appellees.
All right.
Thank you.
I'm going to allow them a brief rebuttal. I'll allow you to come back for your brief rebuttal. But let's keep it to 2 or 3 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. So, again, I would ask, because we do have a lot of folks who have been waiting outpatiently for some time.
And I can't thank the court and the justices enough for the additional time. It's an important issue, and I know the court's taking it very seriously and wants to work here. This whole four-step process is a travesty because it is directly consistent to what the state argued in December of 2007, December 14th, it filed a motion for summary judgment opposing our proposal that we should take the $600 million in Act 14, amortize that over the liability period, and figure out what the state could have done with the $600 million that it should have had. The state opposed that and said lack of funding cannot be used to prove the lots would have been available and that we are liable for damages for the period when they would have been available. Now that the shoe's on the other foot, we've won on causation and liability. The state has an appealed liability ruling. The state is trying to turn the tables, and they should be stopped from referring to this idea of funding.
Mr. Verity, I'm sorry to interrupt you because I know you do have limited time, but I'm interested in the arguments surrounding the financial requirement of financial viability. And how do you respond to Mr. Wadsworth's argument? I mean, Mr. Granny made a very good argument about it's okay to require it, but not to limit damages to a person on the list. Mr. Wadsworth says it's a matter of causation because the breaches don't cause the person. How do you respond? Not to be able to get a homestead.
So the first place to look is Section 207 of the Homes Commission Act, because it doesn't say what Mr. Wadsworth said it says, which is that you're required to occupy. It says may be required to occupy. The idea of financial qualifications cycles back to 60 years of its mismanagement and underfunding of the trust asset. That's the only reason it exists. Had the trust asset been properly managed, there would be no waiting list, there would be sufficient resources, and there would be no argument that lack of financial wherewithal should disqualify anyone. Now, let's look at our statute. Our statute is intended.
Say that again.
Right.
Even if they had come through with all their requirements and they had managed not breach their duties under the trust and had provided homestead lots and for these claimants, residential lots.
Right.
How does that mean that the claimants would have financially qualified or that they would be on the land now?
What I'm saying is the use of financial qualifications is a device to deal with the lack of development by the department of occupiable homesteads. They have a limited inventory of homesteads. What? They have more demand than they have inventory.
Sure.
And because of that, they shut the door in the face of poor people. That's what happens. And Mr. Wazir was saying, that's fine. It isn't supported by the Act. And if you look at Section 4, and I really just implore the court to look at Section 4 of the Admission Act.
If they had managed it correctly, how would it not have shut the door on poor people if they had, in your phrasing, if they had residential lots that were zoned for?
I'm missing the connection. Justice Nakagawa, I'm going to answer your question, but I'm also going to say before I answer it, we're now stepping across the line into how could we fix the trust. My simple answer to that is receivership.
No, I'm asking this as but, you just argued.
Right. So this is the way it works, is if you have a trust corpus that consists of land and you have money, you under Section 207, 208, and 214 of the Act, the state can lend money. The state is a lender under the Hawaii Homes Commission Act.
People still have to qualify to get a loan even from the state.
But the state
you're talking about the state giving money.
But the state can have a revolving fund if it has sufficient resources that helps poor people get loans. Another thing the state could do, which was discussed by Cully Watson when he was the director, and it was a great idea, was to take some of the trust corpus and develop it as multifamily housing. Because if you're any rational person who's offered the choice of a lease in a condo for $1 per year plus rent versus living on the beach, what is their choice going to be? I want to flip the coin on your question and ask a question of my own. What is Mrs. Bright supposed to do? Mrs. Bright testified that she raised her family on the beach in Waimanalo for a period of time. She's not going to have any receipts. She would not have had financial wherewithal at a time when the department had within its inventory residential properties or undeveloped land that it could develop for people just like her.
I'm sorry if you took my question to mean that I thought that claimants should have receipts.
I'm straying. But the point is financial qualifications cannot be imposed because the Admission Act doesn't permit it, first of all. Secondly, the department's own statute says you're supposed to lend these folks money. You're supposed to give them a helping hand. You, the department, are supposed to develop residential properties. Not only residential, but agricultural as well. They've not done any of this. Now, we're not going to fix the department through this case, but I'm trying to respond to you in a way that lets you know that the department has always had the power to address poverty and hasn't done so, which is why we're here today. I realize I'm way over time, but if I could just have three more points, Your Honor.
Please keep.
Justice Nakayama asked me a question about are there any other cases that deal with the issue of present value. I just had a complete blank. Nelson, of course, which the court has seen twice, addresses that directly and acknowledges that in the case of the department, that funding has to be expressed in terms of present value. The class remedy of fair market rental value, that cycles back to the class certification orders. And I said this at the beginning, and I'm going to say it again. They did not appeal the class certification order. Once that happens, as you, Chief Justice, pointed out, the court is bound to find a reasonable measure for what out-of-pocket losses would be. As Justice Wilson pointed out, a sampling 122 sales over the period on a small lot in Miami, not a 15,000 square foot lot in Kahala, and using that as a measure of fair market rental value is eminently reasonable. The method that the state wants is going to throw us back into the hopper for another 20 years for a statute that the legislators and the governor both said should be resolved within a very short period of time.
I don't want to cut you off. Are there any final thoughts, Mr. Gary?
Right. Just on the measure of damages for a beneficiary who's deprived of the use of land for trover and conversion under Section 182 of the Restatement of Trusts is the value of the property deprived. That's what we're asking for here. It's fully consistent with the idea of this court's definition of actual damages in the cases that we've cited. Again, we're eminently grateful, and on behalf of the beneficiaries, I want to thank the court for its careful questions and its attention this morning. Thank you.
Mr. Wiseman.
On this point of whether the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act says may rather than shall, it's true that the current version says may, but I also quoted the version of statehood, which says shall. The lessee shall occupy and commence to use or cultivate the tract as his home or form, home or farm within 1 year after the lease is made. So during at least most of the class period, it was shall. Turning to the other points that counsel made, Nelson is inapplicable to this issue for the reasons that we've stated in our brief. Also, the argument regarding our not having appealed the class certification orders is irrelevant. A class can always be decertified in part. If the court agrees with us on the issues we raised regarding the merits, the damages problems here, we could go back to the circuit court and possibly, depending on what the court's rulings are, move to decertify certain issues regarding damages. That really depends on what the rulings are here. A class, you know, is never set in stone.
I think we've pointed out several errors here that the court will need to address that may in certain respects affect the class. And finally, to answer Justice Nakayama's question earlier about having a model that allows for damages, sort of for class damages, I just wanted to point out that the statute, which again has to guide us here, HRS section 674-2 states that claimants can recover, quote, direct monetary out-of-pocket loss sustained by the claimant individually rather than the beneficiary class generally. So I think the statute allows for a process under which some issues are determined on a class-wide basis, and that ultimately there has to be proof of individual damages, whether that's through a claims process or some other mechanism.
Mr. Wadsworth, you don't think the Circuit Court was anticipating that there would be a claims process that would involve focus on individuals at a certain point in the claims process?
Oh, the court adopted an order that provides for a claims process, Your Honor. So, yes. So, in conclusion, we ask that the court reverse the judgment and remand the case consistent with the various arguments that we've made in our briefs. And thank you for your time.
Well, thank you to our attorneys on both sides today. We're going to take this matter under advisement.
Eku Iluna, please rise. Ua ho'obalolo ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo kie ke hanahana. This honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.